Good morning. Welcome to Sunstone, Session 101, our devotional, Salt Lake City, 2006. I remind you that admission to this session is by ticket only. Please identify that at the opening door. I ask you to remember to turn off cell phones or any other kind of noise machines. At the end of our session, which is 30 minutes, there may or may be not time for questions, as Dennis Clark provides. I will now introduce the speaker, Dennis Clark. He's a longtime friend of mine. We met in 1968 when we were roommates in Salzburg, Austria, on a semester abroad tour. Dennis has a wife, Valerie, lives in Provo, and is the father of six children. The rest of this introduction is not my words, they're his. Dennis Clark spent 7 years as a graduate student at the University of Washington, washing out of a PhD program in English. He left the university with three master's degrees, poetry, English, and librarianship. He managed to work as a librarian in the historical department of the LDS Church, which he left after 2 years when he was told he would never get another promotion there. He spent 26 years and 4 months and a few odd days in the employ of the city of Orem, Utah, as a division manager in the Orem Public Library, most of that time wrestling with issues of automation, cataloging, and, as a sop in his last aging years, circulation, and choosing audiobooks as well. It was when a page working in circulation asked him, after a discussion of how to better improve circulation, why there was division in the library and they couldn't just all get along, that he knew he had failed at managing Division II and retired. He now lives in elegant penury on dwindling retirement funds, tied to stock market investments of the kind George Bush thinks all Americans should enjoy in an ownership society. Turn the time over to Dennis.
I usually commit these indiscretions before a smaller audience. I hope you'll pardon my nervousness. I first heard the etymology of the word testimony from a seminary teacher in the early 60s, noting that the first element of the word derives from the classical Latin testis. He told me that the word arises from the manner of bearing witness in a Roman court. A man would stand before the judge, cupping his testes in his hands, and somewhat as we swear on the Bible, deliver his statement of what he had seen with the implicit oath, "By all that I hold dear, I swear truthfully before this court." As I was preparing a lesson on walking in the light of testimony from the Harold B. Lee manual from a high priest group, I decided to use this arcane bit of knowledge. So being the librarian that I am, I looked the word up in my American Heritage Dictionary. The etymology didn't check out. Since I was preparing the lesson 10 minutes before sacrament meeting, I was just about to run out the door when my son, the movie critic, came by, glanced at my outline, and noticed the dictionary. Ah, the old dictionary definition gambit, eh? "Actually, the word has rather interesting etymology," I said. "You're not going to tell a high priest about cupping your testicles while swearing before a judge, are you?" "Well," I said, rushing out the door of the study, "that's not really the etymology. Everyone uses that story to make the church look ridiculous," he yelled at my back as I ascended from the basement, lugging that huge red dictionary, my briefcase, my outline, and the lesson manual. "Harold B. Lee, it ain't. Indo-European, however, it is." More than that, I did not yet know, so I had no Solomonic rejoinder from my wise-ass son, but I had seen the Indo-European roots of the word, and they were surprisingly blonde. After settling in sacrament meeting to prepare the lesson, I returned to that etymology. The American Heritage Dictionary gives as the etymology of testimony Middle English, from Latin testimonium, from testis, witness. See tre in appendix. Now, the appendix of the American Heritage Dictionary offers a reconstructed Proto-Indo-European root of a word, and sometimes the glimpse it offers of history is fascinating. As you might expect from its sound, the root of the Latin testis, hence of testimony, is the ancestor of the word three in English. But testis is a compound form, and the second part, the st, derives from the root sta, or to stand. The final I serves as the compounding or nominalizing element. The sense of the reconstructed compound form in Proto-Indo-European is thus a third person standing by. It wasn't until I got chalk in hand and stood before the blackboard that I thought to ask, what is a third person standing by? But knowing that correct etymology, I had opened the lesson with the first false etymology. My home teaching companion, a quondam bishop, a recent and newly re-returned missionary, got up and walked out. But he had warned me he would. He's a stake auditor and seems to be performing an audit just about every month. He was going to do three that day. And he walked out with a smile on his face, probably wondering when I would get to the qualification or redemption of this absurd image. So he missed my explanation of that first etymology, that it is what linguists call a folk etymology, although the more politically correct linguists now call them fake etymologies. You can usually tell a folk etymology because there's a story attached to a puzzling word, like the one about posh being derived from an acronym stenciled on the baggage of passengers to India, thus P-O-S-H. That one fooled even Click and Clack the Tappet Brothers and Fine Folk themselves. When my home teaching companion walked out, he was shaking his head and chuckling to himself. It was about that time that I asked myself, and then the class, if a testis is a third person standing by, who are the other two? I asked them to imagine a scene where there are three people and one is standing by. Is he an innocent bystander? Well, not if in the language of those people he is a witness. The Barnhart Dictionary of Etymology expands on the American Heritage Dictionary's terse derivation in its entry for testament. Latin testis is cognate with Oscan tristis, witness, and is thought by most scholars to be a reduced form of tristis, a compound whose first element is related to tres, three, and the second element to stare, stand, as in stare decisis. So that its original sense was that of one standing as a third, in reference to the witness standing as a third entity in a lawsuit. So the other two must be disputants, parties to a disagreement. If you are a witness, if you are called to testify, what will your testimony concern? Well, obviously, the matter of the dispute. That immediately raised other questions. Who is the judge? Who are the jury, if there be one? What are the consequences of the trial? Under what legal code is the trial being conducted? In what jurisdiction? And this is where I ran into trouble with my high priests, those who are still awake. I tried to relate all this to the story of the war in heaven. We could agree that the disputants were most likely Lucifer and Yahweh, and that they offered two different views of how we should live in mortality. I persuaded them that we were each witnesses to that dispute. When I asked them who the judge was, they could even agree with me to call the judge Elohim, that plurality of glory. But when I suggested that in this court the judge is and must be disinterested, I ran into opposition. Another former bishop suggested that the Elohim would have been a passionate advocates for one course of action, not aloof judges. How then, I asked, could their free agency, or as my home teaching companion following Bruce McConkie and Boyd Packer prefers to say, moral agency, be preserved if the most powerful being around was an active advocate for one choice? Instead of having to understand the arguments presented by two brothers and choose between them, all we would have to do is follow the leader. And that's when I had my epiphany. If we are witnesses, we testify to what we've seen. Our testimony should be concerned only with that. In this dispute, the disagreement centers around the peril of freedom and the conflict generated by choice. Whatever our role in the war in heaven, our role now is that of witnesses. And the jury we address is a jury of our peers. It is our obligation to tell the jury what we have felt, what we know, that is pertinent to the matter. So what is pertinent? I've wrestled with that question most of my life, so I was pleased to find that G. Ernest Wright, addressing it in his introduction to the Anchor Bible translation of the book of Joshua. Israel had no idea of a two-realm theory of knowledge, one of a supernal universal good and one of a world where human beings live. There was only one realm where significant knowledge was obtainable. That was their own life as a people in the midst of the nations with whom they had contact. Yet in this world they indeed affirmed that God is good. For Israel, then, the basic data for theology, i.e. for the comprehension of human meaning, was derived from history. In other words, it was characteristic of Israel to explain and expound their faith and allegiance to Yahweh, as the Lord's name was known, by a narrative of what he had done. Adopting this view, we should testify to what we have seen in our own lives, not to some realm of supernal universal good. Or we should testify to that. At the end of his campaign of conquest, at the end of his life, Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel at Shechem and delivered a farewell speech which becomes a ritual reenactment of the Exodus and the conquest. It begins with words attributed to the Lord, including his comments on Balak ben Zippor. He sent to summon Balaam ben Beor as so as to curse you, but I was not willing to listen to Balaam. He emphatically blessed you. I rescued you from his power. And ending, I've presented to you a land for which you had not labored and towns which you did not build, but on which you live. From vineyards and olive orchards which you did not plant, you eat. That is incidentally the translation from my source, the Anchor Bible. Joshua then presents Israel with the opportunity to renew their covenant. If in your view it is a bad thing to serve Yahweh, then choose today whom you will serve, either the gods of your ancestors served from the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites on whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we are going to serve Yahweh. Verses 16 through 27 record the formal swearing of the covenant. We often don't read that whole chapter. Just the famous verse 15, but the entire chapter is a very formal renewing of covenants, perhaps as formal as our temple rites. And it sets up the history in Judges and the captivity of Israel under Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. If the story of our premortal existence, riven by a disagreement as to how we should live outside our parents' presence, means anything, it stands as a parable of choice, moral choice. In the person of Yahweh and Lucifer, the choice is presented to us. On the one hand, a world which we find ourselves in constant conflict with others and under obligation to resolve the conflicts quickly. As Jesus said, agree with thine adversary quickly whilst thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge and the judge deliver thee to the officer and thou be cast into prison. And on the other hand, a world in which all conflict is resolved through the application of divine love, regardless of mortal will. As the story stands, the ironies abound. Chief among them, we live in a world in which he who is champion of divine peace is the chief agent of contention, and the champion of free choice is the voice urging us to live in peace, following divine strictures, rather than to contend. In this world, we all take the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil from Lucifer's hand. When I was one of the young folks, I constructed folk etymologies around whatever words puzzled me. One of the biggest puzzles had to do with testimony. What does it mean to bear testimony? Or is that bear? And if so, which bear? Just after I was baptized, my father stood up in fast and testimony meeting, pulled me up to stand alongside him, and holding my hand, bore his testimony of the rightness of my baptism. I do not recall the words, only that he clutched my hand as he spoke and kept squeezing the knuckles together the way one does when one shakes hands with comic overkill. I had the impression that he was bearing secrets to the world and to the ward, and probably expected me to. Perhaps that is why I thought at first that bearing testimony was like bearing your soul, to get something off your chest, to make a clean breast of it. Bear in that usage is relatively uncomplicated. It goes all the way back in roughly the same form through Old English bear to the hypothetical German basse to Proto-Indo-European bosso, which means naked. So that nowadays when you want to talk about bear, you have to emphasize the word and say bare naked or butt naked. To bear one's testimony is to strip it of all the fine twine linen we normally dress it in and present it as naked as a newborn babe, all red and wrinkled potential. It is the exact opposite of this kind of testimony. I'd like to bear my testimony. I know this church is true. I'm grateful for my mom and dad and for the prophet, too. I know the bishop loves me and my teacher now and then and the Book of Mormon story, name of Jesus Christ, amen. This kind of recitation seems so sterile because there's no experience behind it, because no witness is born. It grows out of a pupil's bravado, often in response to teacher's staccato challenge, rather than out of a discipline of a pilgrim through a world of conflict and strife. It is the equivalent of a rote prayer and just as effective. The other verb, to bear, means both to carry and to bring forth, meanings the word is born since its origin. The Proto-Indo-European root bear means to carry, also to bear children. Both meanings can be applied metaphorically to testimony. A testimony is a burden that we carry about with us and a child we bring forth. Interesting enough, Barnhart tells us that before 1382, testimony referred to the Ten Commandments as inscribed on the two tablets of stone, or the tablets of stone themselves in the Wycliffe Bible. Now let's ignore the image of the two stones here. Let's allow our Latin lover to unhand his witnesses and the implications or and walk away. And incidentally, if you're wondering how the word came to have the meaning it has in polite English today, the word testis, it's a euphemism. It appears to be the means by which you could witness to the virility of, say, a bull out in the field. You looked at his witnesses. Even in old Latin, and I don't know what the Latin would have been, the street Latin would have been, but even in old Latin, that's a euphemism. Having knowledge of God is a burden in the way Isaiah writes of it. For example, in chapter 13, verse 1, the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, did see. He delivered himself of these burdens in poems of great power and vigor. That is how we should deliver ourselves of our testimony, not in doggerel, but in poems of beauty, lyrics fashioned from the events of our lives day to day. But my earliest image of testifying relied on a folk etymology one I invented on my own. I imagined a bear, perhaps a grizzly, awakened in winter from hibernation, charging forth irritated and angry, perhaps a mother bear roaring. That was a real bear of a testimony. Maybe that was the way the old men who woke up to testify seemed to shout out their convictions. It certainly would not bear close scrutiny, and I think I was reaching even then. But there was something in the image of a bellowing grizzly that seemed to fit the testimony. I made up that story because I wanted to know why a bear had anything to do with old people standing up and rambling on and on about intangible qualities of essence and existence. I wanted stories. not exhortations. I wanted stories as powerful as the one Joseph Smith told about his doubts and their resolution. Again, as a child, I was fascinated with the extreme physicality of Joseph Smith's wrestle before God. Quote, "It was the first time in my life that I had made such an attempt, for amidst all my anxieties, I had never as yet made the attempt to pray vocally. After I had retired to the place where I had previously designed to go, having looked around me and finding myself alone, I kneeled down and began to offer up the desires of my heart to God. I had scarcely done so when immediately I was seized upon by some power which entirely overcame me and had such an astonishing influence over me as to bind my tongue so that I could not speak. Thick darkness gathered around me, and it seemed to me for a time as if I were doomed to sudden destruction. But, exerting all my powers to call upon God to deliver me out of the power of this enemy, which had seized upon me, and at the very moment when I was ready to sink into despair and abandon myself to destruction, not to an imaginary ruin, but to the power of some actual being from the unseen world who had such marvelous powers I had never before felt in any being, just at this moment of great alarm, I saw a pillar of light exactly over my head, above the brightness of the sun, which descended gradually until it fell on me. It no sooner appeared than I found myself delivered from the enemy which held me bound." Everything about that story enthralled me. I had felt nothing like that whenever I knelt to pray. No power bound my tongue, no darkness thicker than my brother's breathing gathered around me, no despair, no actual being, no unseen world, and no pillar of light. This is not how phenomena behave in my world. Darkness had the thickness only of shadow. Light moved at the speed of light. And after this death, what rebirth? When I came to myself again, I found myself lying on my back, looking up into heaven. When the light had departed, I had no strength. But soon, recovering in some degree, I went home. If only I could wrestle like that before God. If only I could feel my strength leaving me, flowing into some unseen world. Then I could testify. I felt certain. I could bear my testimony like a wrestler bearing his biceps. That would be a testimony to flaunt. With typical adolescent paranoia, Joseph felt that no one could understand his experiences. He had lived it. This was common among all the sects, he wrote, all united to persecute me. Even allowing for the normal bravado of adolescence, this seems like a gross overestimate of the likely notice he might have attracted. This 14-year-old boy doomed to the necessity of obtaining scanty maintenance by his daily labor. Yet Joseph persisted in bearing witness to what he had seen, echoing Peter's experience with another vivid vision. "Who am I that I can withstand God?" And he continued to feel persecuted for the burden of his vision, for not withstanding God. It is a common experience, sitting in fast meeting, to hear someone interrupt the silence of reflection and meditation and say from the podium, "I hate to let the time go to waste." If our fast has been to any purpose, it is in those moments of contemplation we have been preparing for. I have come to regard those minutes of waiting as the most valuable part of a fast. I don't feel that the time is going to waste like water flowing into Las Vegas. What I am doing is waiting for a still, small voice. It is not in the rushing wind. It is not in the war of words and tumult of opinions. It is not in the echoes of the same words heard over and over. that I hear that voice. It is in the contemplation of the stories of other people's wrestles before God. I don't respond well to the witness who tells me of any matter, in any circumstance, that he knows anything beyond the shadow of a doubt. Only God can know beyond the shadow of a doubt. I live on Shadow Mountain. I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. But I have never seen the shadow of the dial go back 10 degrees. I live in the shadow of a man who cried out with all the pain of a lost certainty, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." If I occasionally feel forsaken, that cri de coeur offers me more comfort than any testimony unshadowed by doubt. We have some idea of the consequence of the court in which we bear testimony. We apprehend, if dimly, the consequences of the matter at hand. But we do not know, we cannot know, the legal code under which this trial is conducted. And much as we might love the judge, we do not know them. The Mormon cosmology holds that as man now is, God once was, as God now is, man may become. It suffers from the same opacity of all cosmologies. We look back through the lens of that couplet to an infinite regression of gods rather than to an eternal uncreated creator. But the effect is exactly the same. Before eternity, before infinity, the mind, well, at least my mind, quails. When I sit in fasting in testimony meeting, what I'm waiting for is a story, not a retreat to the unknowable. I want standing before me a witness who has opened his heart, not clutched his testes in a death grip, while he asserts supreme knowledge, divine knowledge. As a member of the jury, I want to know what this witness has seen, what he has felt, what he has done, so that when I stand to bear my testimony, it will be before friends. What I want in a testimony is something more testy and less moany. Thank you.
We appreciate Dennis and these erudite remarks on testimony meeting, something that we can all reflect upon. The microphone here is set up for questions, but as I look at the clock, this session has ended, and other sessions begin in about 14 minutes. So with that, we appreciate your being here, and we'll end the session. Thank you.